New polling conducted by Protect Life Michigan asking the question about the impact of abortion victim photography, not just on people's take on abortion or even on legislation surrounding abortion, but even how it impacts people's perception of pro-lifers. Stay tuned. Hi, folks. Welcome back to the Pro-Life Guys podcast, a show dedicated to equipping you with the tools that you need to have compassionate and compelling conversations about abortion so together we can change minds, save lives, and transform our culture. My name is Cam. I am the host of the show. Welcome back for those of you who are long-time or even short-time listeners, and welcome to those of you who may be new. This may be your first episode, and if it is, I welcome you to the show. I hope that you'll stick around and maybe even track back on some of the episodes that we've covered already. We've had a ton of incredible guests come on the show before. We've had Lila Rose, we've had Stephanie Gray Connors, we've had Josh Brom, we've had tons of people, Lisa Rowe and Laura Clausen, and lots of really good people. And so definitely worth checking out. If you've missed any of those episodes, we do a program called Humans of the Pro-Life Movement, trying to capture some of the incredible heroes that are involved in the pro-life movement in different ways. And so check out those episodes as well. As I mentioned off the top, today's episode, we are back again talking about abortion victim photography. I know that some of you are probably wondering, like, why do we have to do another episode on this? Don't we do it enough? I get there's a ton of conversation out there. I get that there are people who are no longer dithering about abortion victim photography. I feel like the culture has changed dramatically since I first got involved in the pro-life movement back in 2009, where abortion victim photography was very much pitched as a theory of, we're pretty sure that we could make some change if we do this based on historical precedent and all that kind of thing. Whereas now, and there's a lot of pushback at that time against the theory of, sure, you might be able to capture some of that historical data, but also what about pissing off people, and what about making everybody mad at you and driving people away from the pro-life movement? I feel like that has died down, at least in some parts of the world and some parts of the country. I know that here in Calgary, when I first started working for CCBR, there were very, very few churches or pro-life groups that had any interest in partnering with CCBR whatsoever. And now it is difficult to keep up with the number of requests we have to partner on different programs or projects, both publicly and visibly and behind the scenes. We have politicians that are constantly reaching out to us to help train their canvassers and get involved in their lit drops and whatnot. We have pregnancy support centers that want to collaborate with us at conferences and conventions and whatnot. We have a lot of people that are really coming around on the strategy, because in some ways the proof has been in the pudding. And that's what I'm going to talk about today with Trevor Polo. One anecdote that I think is really cool, because we just got back from Florida, where we're doing our abortion awareness project, where we have these frankly gigantic pictures of abortion victims and they're challenging students on campus with this very, very large display that's often, I mean, the signs are like, I don't know, 8 feet high and probably 10 feet wide and that kind of thing. Like very large signs that go all the way around a quad, challenging students to really reflect upon their worldview on abortion. We have dozens of volunteers around to engage people in conversation, that kind of thing. And I remember on the fourth day, so we take two groups down there. I was there for the whole first group and the first portion of the second group. And so the fourth day of our first group, we were at the University of Central Florida, which for trivia people out there is, I believe, the largest student population campus in America, with just over 70,000 students, which is wild to think about, 70,000 students. And on the last day, I was literally sitting behind the display. So it's often, for those of you who are watching on YouTube, a bit of a U-shape display. And then we have something of a little picnic table area on the inside where people can come and write down their testimonies and debrief conversations and grab a bite to eat and a drink of water before heading back out there. So I was sitting behind the display talking to people as they were coming back, debriefing their conversations while I was tabulating the conversational outcomes that we were blessed to be a part of over that first week down in Florida. And I was picking my head up and scanning the behind to see who's in behind the display. And I saw a young fellow that I didn't recognize, so I knew that he wasn't a part of the display. He found the opening. He followed a few of the volunteers in, and I could tell that they weren't coming with him. And so I didn't really know what was up. I put down my pen, and I brought my notebook with me for whatever reason. And I went over, and I approached him as he was coming to try to initiate a conversation with us. And I introduced myself and said, "Hey, my name's Cam. What can I do for you?" And he said, "Hey, my name is Leif, and I'm one of the leaders of the Calvinist Reformed or the Reformed Christian Club here on campus. And I want to talk to you guys about this display because we just did one of our semester socials last night. We did a volleyball social for the club, and all of us were talking about how this can't be the best use of your time. This is driving people away from the pro-life movement. This is turning more people off than you'd ever see change. Like, why are you guys doing this? And why don't you do something else?" And so I said, "You know what? I agree. These pictures are really, really difficult to look at, and they can provoke a lot of different reactions. Imagine that 200 born children, 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds, were getting killed every day in Florida. That's where we're at. So those are the statistics that I was relying upon. Imagine 200 born children were being killed every day. And the vast majority of people in Florida thought that that was okay. And those that didn't think that it was okay weren't really responding with the urgency necessary. And you were trying to convince them to act. But people were just either apathetic or outright hostile towards the message that you shouldn't be killing innocent 2-year-olds. What would you do? Would you show the reality of what was happening to these 2-year-old children being killed day in and day out?" He thought about it for a moment. He's like, "You know, that kind of makes sense." And I said, "Okay, well, if we would be willing to do that for born children getting killed day after day, why not preborn children?" And then he was on board. He knew that preborn children were valuable humans, and he was pro-life himself. And so I went beyond that. We talked a little bit about how every historical social reform movement has followed in many ways a very similar formula, showcasing the reality of what abortion, what the injustice does to the victims. And then I shared with him the statistics that we had had to that point, around 1,000 conversations with people in Florida, about 750 of whom supported abortion in one way or another, and that over 250 of them had become fully pro-life by the end of a single conversation. And his jaw just dropped. And we might have talked for maybe 10 minutes, and he ended the conversation saying, "Hey, not only do I want to thank you now for what you guys are doing, but how do I get involved? And how do I get a speaker to come and talk to my Christian club? Because I think that if you shared this with them, they would all come around as well." So he went from, "You guys are hurting the movement and my entire club agrees with me," to, "You guys are right and this is working and this makes sense, and I would like you to train me and my team and my club in how to make as much of an impact as I possibly could," which is just really, really cool. Trevor Polo from Protect Life Michigan has been on the show before. He's an incredible dude. He's a straight up pro-life guy. Highly recommend. I will drop in the show notes the previous episode that I did with him. And this is going to be a longer episode. I do warn you up front. It's going to be a longer episode. The recording is just over an hour. And so it might be a couple different bite-sized portions that you're looking at throughout this week, that kind of thing. But I do really want to encourage you to tune into it, because not only is new polling data really valuable, right? The polling data that CCBR has is really, really good, but most of it was done in 2015, 2016, 2017. And so it's getting older and older, and it's getting, I don't want to call it stale, but it's always exciting to have new polling data. And I really appreciate how Trevor and the team at Protect Life Michigan captured not only the impact that abortion victim photography has on people's acceptance or rejection of abortion, but also asking questions about legislation. And most interestingly, the impact that viewing abortion victim images has on the perception of the pro-life movement. And so I think it's a really cool conversation. Check it out. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Trevor Polo from Protect Life Michigan. All right, Trevor, thanks a ton for joining the show again. Repeat guest. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me again.
Yeah, this is cool. We're going to dive into some real cool stuff because I get to put back on kind of my scientific goggles, which I have on a fair bit of the time, but I feel like less and less compared to before I got involved in the pro-life movement. For anyone who doesn't know Trevor, he was give me an elevator pitch of how you got involved in the pro-life movement, just for those that might not have heard the first episode that you joined the show for.
Yeah. You know, I started as a pro-choice, a very passive pro-choice kid in college at Michigan State University, got exposed for the first time through philosophy classes about the pro-choice and pro-life position. And God just really captured my heart when I heard the philosophy of the pro-life position. But really, the first time that I ever saw a video actually from Create Equal of the reality of abortion, it broke my heart and set me on a path towards leveraging every skill and every resource I have to try to end abortion in Michigan. And I've been able to work since 2013 with Protect Life Michigan, which is a statewide network, very similar to CCBR in a lot of ways, that exists to bring the reality of abortion to college campuses and communities across the state and change hearts and minds on the issue.
Well, love it. And praise God that you are bringing not only yourself, but also your skill set into this as well, because as we're going to dive into today, the metrics and being able to develop smart goals and measurable goals and all that kind of stuff is going to be really, really valuable, particularly with where things are at in America right now and ultimately around the world. But I think that you guys are in a very, very unique kind of situation where the tides are, I don't know if they're clear. Like, does it feel like there's a clear shift of one direction or another, or does it feel as tumultuous from within as it does from its appearance from the outside, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think, you know, the 2022 was a year of whiplash for us because we had this incredible high of seeing a goal of the pro-life movement for the past 50 years realized, where Roe v. Wade was overturned. And for the first time in my lifetime and so many people's lifetimes, we could actually pass real protections for unborn children in the United States. And it was a feeling that I'll never forget, really, when that happened. But ever since then, it's been a very, very difficult ride in the pro-life movement here in the States. And we've seen the backlash against that decision lead to even more radical pro-abortion protections being put in place across states like Michigan and Ohio, in particular, that I've been involved with. And this year, we're expecting potentially another half dozen or up to a dozen potential states to fall as well, enshrining radical abortion, even beyond what Roe really provided into their constitution. And, you know, it's difficult because, you know, we see that we had a major victory in 2022, but at the same time, we see that there is this gap in people's understanding of who the unborn fundamentally are and how we should treat them that is leading to their lives still being at risk, even though we've made some advances in the legislative or political realm, I guess, over the past 50 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great way to put it. And I apologize to our audience who may not be cinema people. I don't know if you're a big Rocky Balboa kind of guy, but I feel like in some ways there's a little bit of a... I don't know how much the pro-abortion and pro-choice movement is underestimating the pro-life movement in America anymore. I feel like for so long, especially with all the trigger laws that were going into effect, like it was so cool up here in Canada to be like, hey, look at all of this pro-life legislation that was put in place over the last decade or whatever. And I feel like in some ways the pro-life movement was punching above their weight with how successful they were politically maneuvering their manpower, knowing that they didn't have an overwhelming majority, but using those pro-lifers in such a way that enacted a lot of really, really meaningful trigger laws. And then the Dobbs decision comes out and Apollo Creed realizes that Rocky Balboa is actually a really good boxer. And holy moly, I just got embarrassed on the largest stage by some random boxer. And how much better Rocky has to prepare for round two, kind of thing. I don't know if that metaphor makes any sense on your end, but I feel like the underestimating might be gone. You might be exposed now.
I think so too. And I think to throw another analogy on it, you know, my background is in the tech world, and there's this idea of like, if you the pro-life movement, I think, was kind of operating in what's called like a stealth mode, basically, whereas like if you're a new tech startup and you want to take on the Google or the Amazon of the world, you can't roll out there with your product, and cause they're going to take it over. They're going to reproduce it faster than you can possibly do. And you're going to be out before you even had a chance to get started. So you operate in stealth mode, you operate in secrecy, and you start building this product and start testing it and start really deploying some features so that when you deploy it, you've taken them by surprise. And I think in some ways the pro-life movement was operating in stealth mode in a sense, because ever since Roe v. Wade, the pro-choice movement could kind of sit back and relax to oversimplify it, I guess, because they had the protection of the Supreme Court, they had the protection of the media, they had the protection of the political operatives. They had all this in place that the pesky little pro-life movement that's operating in stealth mode, not really a concern to them. But when Roe v. Wade fell, and that, unfortunately, I think really awakened this kind of sleeping giant of the pro-choice movement and the pro-choice media, the pro-choice political complex and the abortion industry itself. And it activated so many people, and they spun those tools so well and so quickly to motivate this kind of population, this popular reaction against the pro-life movement that I think we intellectually probably expected, but I don't think to your point, we really understood what was about to happen. And that's just being honest. I don't think that I'm not saying anything negative about any in particular person, because I'm saying I underestimated it, I think, in a lot of ways too. And it's just a reality check. And yeah, we're ready for round two now. And we have to know, we know better now who our opponent is and what their schemes or messages and things like that are going to be and how we should be able to react.
Yeah. And I think that this leads really well into the meat and potatoes of our conversation today in what does this mean for the pro-life movement and how we engage now that, not that we were operating per se in the shadows, but now that all the lights are on, now that this is no longer a cold war. I feel like this is a hot cultural war, that the battle lines are drawn and there's not going to be that opportunity for stealth engagement anymore. What does that mean for how we engage? And I know that I mentioned this briefly to you before we started the recording, but I'd love to get your take on the idea of how for so long, so many of the pro-lifers that I admire, and I'm sure many of them that you admire as well, one of their leading virtues and attributes has been their faithfulness. That even in light of the dark cloud of Roe over top of America and how daunting it seemed, the faithfulness of the pro-lifer going out and witnessing in front of the abortion facility or signing that petition over and over and over again, really trying to make their ballot count for votes and all that kind of thing, the faithfulness of pro-lifers has been one of our greatest calling cards. But wondering about whether we need to really build upon that and really start evaluating more our successfulness and the metrics that we're using to gauge ultimately the return on investment. That I have seen people be willing to endure all kinds of derogatory, borderline harassment while doing all sorts of different forms of pro-life outreach. And at times, as I'm driving by a Life Chain or a 40 Days for Life or something like that, I thank the Lord that they're out there. But I do also wonder, like, if they're willing to endure all of that, imagine what they might be able to achieve if they're willing to endure a slight amount more and implement another kind of activity. And I guess all that to say, your thoughts on now implementing more and more a smart, metric-driven approach to how we engage in this culture war that we're faced with that doesn't have the privilege of stealth anymore. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really great observation, because, you know, like we were talking about earlier and like you've mentioned, there is this element where we're called sometimes, like, not specifically called to a certain thing, or it's not clear necessarily what we're called to do. So sometimes it's just like, okay, find a good thing, find the next good thing and do it. Whether that's in pro-life work or that's like you're in your city and you're wondering, how can I impact my city? There's one person on the street that I can go out and I can minister to right now. And like, we have to keep doing that. I can think of people in my life and pro-life work in particular that have been doing that for 50 plus years. And I can't wait to see them in heaven, because they're going to be surrounded by so many little kids or whatever they'll be at that point in heaven, that lives that they have saved and people have impacted and the world has not been the same because of that just like grind it out, do the next good thing. But, you know, as I step back and think about, okay, you know, we have a responsibility to make sure that we do the best we can for the glory of God as well, and for the work that he's called us to. And the reality is, the pro-life movement has X amount of dollars, and we have X amount of time, and we have X amount of people. And I want to say, okay, whatever God has entrusted to the pro-life movement, I want to figure out how we can maximize the return on that. And we don't want to be like callously thinking of it as, you know, as a business or whatever. Like we'll use some of those terms maybe. But in the end, you know, there's biblical support for this. Even like the parable of the talents in Matthew, where a master goes away and he leaves his servants a sum of money, 5 talents, 2 talents, and 1 talent, depending on their abilities, their skills, what God has entrusted them with. And when he comes back, 2 of the servants doubled the amount that they were entrusted with, and 1 buried it in the sand because he was afraid to lose it. And the master rewards the one that took what was entrusted to him and maximized the outcome, and punished the one who failed to think strategically and how to maximize what was entrusted to him. So I think we have to look at that and say, okay, how can we take the time, the money, the people that we have, the influence we have, the institutions and powers that we have, whatever it might be, and maximize the lives that are saved, the minds that are changed, the hearts that are brought closer to the truth, and then ultimately the glory that is brought to God because of it.
Absolutely. And I think that's such a valuable approach. And I think that it's worth mentioning as well, as we lead into some of the results that you guys found in the study that you guys conducted, that in evaluating success, it's not necessarily like, I think that it gives the best clarity for the present day. Hopefully it speaks towards the future, Lord willing. I don't think that either you or I are trying to look back into hindsight and trying to critique the work that has been done by pro-lifers before us. This isn't a matter of, was Operation Rescue in the early 90s the most effective use of everyone's time? I don't think that we can speak to that. And even if we could, I don't think that that's our place per se. But rather, I do think that now, as leaders in the current movement, it is our duty, our responsibility, just like it was the duty of those that have gone before us, to evaluate their culture and understand the best ways of meeting their culture and transforming their culture. That's the obligation that's been given to people like you and I. And so, bearing that in mind, share a little bit about the approach that you guys took to develop what I think is an incredible and very, very thorough study to evaluate the impact of abortion victim images in how it influences people's perspective, not only on abortion, but also on pro-life people and legislation as a whole.
Yeah. So just as background, Protect Life Michigan historically has not always used abortion victim imagery. And even some of us on staff have been opposed to it for some of the reasons that I'll talk about. And it was actually back in probably 2017. There's 2 big events that happened. One was Create Equal came and talked to us about their use of imagery. We even told them, we're like, hey, we don't do this right now. We're not really sure how to feel about it, but we're willing to hear your perspective on why you use these photos and why we should consider doing so as well. And then the other thing that happened around that time period was Rebecca, who's a member of our staff here at Protect Life Michigan, went and actually, before she was on staff with us, interned with you guys out in Calgary. And she came back and said, oh my goodness, you guys have no idea what we're missing out on so much that they're doing, that is impacting their cities so much. And we aren't being effective unless we start doing this, basically. So those 2 things happened, and we started using imagery as more and more as like the primary way that we engaged our college campuses that we work with, for example. And since then, we kind of have been wanting to evangelize that more and more to the rest of the pro-life movement, because we've been tracking every single conversation that we've had over that time period. And we do other outreaches as well, non-victim imagery outreaches. And the data that we have internally supports that there's no single tactic that is more effective at changing minds on the issue than the use of imagery, especially because it can scale more than a one-on-one conversation or anything can. So we wanted to, we've gotten feedback, we've gotten some criticism for doing it, like I'm sure you have as well, Cam, from pro-choice people, but even pro-life people as well. So what we wanted to do is say, okay, does this work, and can we prove that it works so that we can be confident in our use of it? If it doesn't work, we don't want to do it. And hopefully so we can help other people see that it's not just something that we're kind of, it's our pet little thing that we do. It's something that we're doing because we intentionally chose it because it works. So there's really kind of four things that we wanted to answer, which is one, when we use victim imagery, how does it make people feel about abortion? You know, the person that's passing by or sees that image, how does it make them feel about abortion? We also wanted to see, how does it make them feel about the unborn child? Not just the one in that picture, but largely unborn children in general. How does it make them feel about pro-life people that are using these images? And then how does it make them feel about potential legislation? So that's really kind of the motivation behind what we did with this study, is we want to answer those questions so that we can be confident in the strategy we're doing. Also, so we can understand maybe some of the demographic breakdown. Maybe this impacts women more than men. Maybe it impacts younger people more than older people. And maybe we can shift our tactics and how we target different areas or something like that based on some of that data as well. But also so that we can go to other people in the movement and say, hey, we're all recognizing right now that the population doesn't seem to be on our side about this issue. Here's our proposal. This seems to be one of the most effective single ways for us to change minds on this issue of abortion at scale in the least amount of time and with the least amount of effort maybe necessary. And we want to submit that to review for the pro-life movement, get feedback on it, get challenges to it, because ultimately our goal is not to say everyone do what PLM and CCBR and Create Equal does. Our goal is to say everyone do what is most effective at changing hearts and saving lives.
Exactly. And I think that's absolutely the best approach. And I remember when we first started doing our polling, which was a number of years ago now, and I feel like there's a lot of questions of like, well, are you nervous about the outcomes? Are you nervous that you're going to be incorrect in your analysis? And I think that that sums it up right there as well, that like, I don't have a personal affinity with abortion victim photography. Right? Like, this isn't a matter of this is my dog in the fight and I want to prove to everybody that my dog is the best, but rather we need to be driven by what is the most effective. And going into any form of polling, if the results show like, hey, it would be way better if you weren't using abortion victim photography, I feel like in a lot of ways I would have a big sigh of relief that on that front. I don't know about you, but like, I feel like the results are not to again, look back at like, you guys are wasting your time or doing it wrong or that kind of thing. And so if we approach these results with an air of how do we best optimize our efforts? How do we best redeem our time? That kind of thing. I think that can be really, really helpful in our analysis of them, in wanting the truth to be clear, not even wanting a particular form of outreach or engagement or messaging to be superior, but rather let's have clarity in the truth so that at the very least we know what to pursue.
Exactly. And,
right?
Yeah. And I think that like, I think you're right in the sense that, I was a little nervous when the results were coming back, in the sense that I was like, well, if I'm wrong, it's going to be really embarrassing. I'm nervous maybe about that. But in the end, yeah, I'm like, well, it's happening. I even was like, I'm telling people ahead of time they're doing this because I want them to know so that I'm not tempted at all to try to hide or cover up or anything like that. I want them to know this is happening so that they can hold me accountable to it also. I would love to find that there's another strategy that doesn't involve me getting yelled at as much and stuff, because like that happens when you do this. When you do something that creates this much tension in society, you're going to get a backlash, and the data supports that, and so we're not hiding that at all. I love a strategy that's more effective and less polarizing. I think a lot of people do, and I think sometimes I guess the challenge I'd have for people that are hesitant or opposed to victim imagery, at least as on its effectiveness, would be to, there is going to be this dissonance that is going to be in you. There is this natural discomfort. Like you're saying, like no one really enjoys using victim imagery. It's uncomfortable. It's tragic. It's sad. It makes me feel all the negative thoughts and negative feelings. And that's good. And that's appropriate, I think I should say, because it displays a very violent dehumanization, act of dehumanization. And we should feel that tragedy and that sadness. But I need to make sure that I don't let that emotional feeling let me dismiss the reality of whether or not it works. I need to make sure that I let the reality of what works triumph over the emotional hesitancies that I might have. Now, if the reality that is that it does not work, then yeah, I'm gonna be overjoyed that I can relieve myself of that emotional distress.
Yeah. And yet, I think you put it perfectly there, that this isn't about the overarching metric isn't simply how often do I get yelled at, though we will get into that and some very surprising results. But maybe let's dive into some of the results. So you mentioned the four kind of categories that he was really evaluating off of kind of support or lack thereof of abortion, mm-hmm. of their understanding of the preborn child, their understanding of or their appreciation, rejection of pro-life people and legislation. So maybe let's crush through them one at a time. Yeah. And maybe you can share some of the results that you guys found with the polling. We won't dive necessarily into all of the methods and the p-value and all that kind of stuff, because I know that that might go over a few people's heads. I know that I had to do a lot of remembering to get back into my university statistics courses to be able to remember what kind of p-values I'm looking for. And so we'll drop in the show notes below the study itself, hopefully. But maybe let's walk through some of the results that you guys found.
Yeah. And just to set up the basic kind of structure of what this survey was, it was a survey of 1,200 U.S. adults. And the methodology that we used to basically present this survey, and we'll ask them a few kind of screening questions to say what, you know, figure out what they basically believe about abortion. Do they think it's morally right, morally wrong? They're unsure. And then get demographics and things on them. And then we split them into two groups. Half of them, about 600 people, are going to get images that are not of victims of abortion. They are general pro-life, basically like pro-life social media graphics that say, that make the pro-life argument, abortion kills an innocent human being, or pro-life, pro-woman, pro-human rights, or there's different images like that. Half the respondents, as they go through the rest of the survey, are going to see variations of those images. The other half are going to see different images of abortion, one from the first trimester, one from the second, one from the third, and it'll rotate through those as they're answering their questions. So as we're going through those results, we're going to be comparing basically how people's opinions were impacted by seeing the reality of abortion compared to a control group, a B group, that saw images that were pro-life but not graphic or did not display the victims themselves. So if we start to just like digging into their reactions to abortion, we wanted to understand when they saw this image or when they saw a non-graphic image, did they see abortion any more or less positively, basically. And when we look at the group that did not see abortion victim imagery, the most common response to how does this image make you feel about abortion was an unchanged opinion. That was the most common. It wasn't the majority. There's a split, but the most common single response was unchanged opinion on abortion. So a general pro-life statement didn't seem to move people very significantly. However, when that same question was asked, hey, what does this image make you feel about abortion? And they saw victim imagery presented, then negative feelings for abortions increased by a little over 17%. So almost half of those respondents immediately upon the scene of an image had an increased negative feeling towards abortion compared to the non-abortion victim imagery group. And even like when we dig more into that, we're like, okay, well, who had the greater impact? And we asked before any images were shown, we said, what do you think about abortion? And there's, you could say it's morally right and justified. I'm completely in support of abortion. You could also say I'm completely against abortion. But then there is options to say, well, I think it's necessary whether it's moral or not. So we kind of consider them like the necessary evil type of argument that we might hear from people. You know, I don't like abortion, but it's necessary. There's also people that were uncertain about the opinion on abortion. And the people who had the strongest reaction to abortion victim imagery based on their initial belief were the people in the middle on the issue. So people who thought it was, you know, a necessary evil or they were uncertain, they were the most impacted by abortion victim imagery. Those that were, when I compare, let's just say the people that were not certain about the issue of abortion in the beginning, the abortion victim imagery group that were not certain about the issue of abortion, over 62% of them expressed less support for abortion when they saw an image compared to only 32% when they saw a pro-life statement. So we can impact that uncertain group by almost 30 more percent positively for our position just by using images versus just pro-life statements.
Huge, right? Like I feel like for you and I who are in the thick of things, like that is a number that I'm tempted at least to gloss over at times. So like 30% gains over the control. Like this is not over nothing, but rather over the control of non-abortion victim image related messaging, an additional 30% more, especially when you scale up. I was on your website. I'm on your website right now, actually. And the impact that you guys had last year of over 1 million touch points with your projects and an added 30%. Sure, if you're talking to 10 people a year, an added 30% is probably still meaningful. But in engaging over 1 million people, an added 30% is tremendous when it comes to gains. And again, like we talked about at the beginning, if we're trying to affect the state, the nation, the world, and there's an awful lot of work to do, something that works 30%, punches 30% higher is incredible. And so that's phenomenal. And I think that is something worth really, really owning. Not that we're not owning it, but like for the audience of knowing that in comparison, this gets us an additional 30%.
Right. Right. A significant change in the actual, like all we're doing is showing a picture. We're not even like,
yeah,
that picture itself by itself with no argument, with no context, with no larger discussion or anything like that. That picture itself moves people over uncertain people over 60% of the time to feel less support for abortion. So we're not talking about, you know, we're literally talking about just swapping one image for another, basically, and you can realize 30% gains. And like, that's a significant gain for a small change, basically, you know?
Totally. Totally. And like, not only is that valuable in Michigan, like I think this would be even more valuable in Canada, where there are so many more people, I feel like, in the mushy middle. That's part of the reason why we take people down to Florida, because they have often, we feel like, a much better defined worldview on abortion, because you guys are often thinking about it a little bit more critically than we are in Canada. And so with an even wider percentage of people in the quote unquote mushy middle, this is phenomenal for Canada, but I know that it's huge in Michigan as well. So let's move on then. So that's their perception on abortion. What was the next thing that you guys were trying to really evaluate?
Yeah. So basically we wanted to understand, you know, how does it make them reconsider their, the value or the understanding they're placing on the unborn child themselves. So can we basically, with these images, humanize an unborn child would be the idea. You know, the theory is kind of that abortion thrives when the victims remain less than human, when they remain anonymous. And we know, like, philosophically maybe, that there is this idea, or psychologically, I guess, where, like, if you can present the face of a victim, there, and I know you guys do this really well, and we're stealing some of that idea, is basically say, you know, show the faces of abortion, because humans identify with other humans via their face more than any other you know characteristic of them. So let's show the face of abortion to bring humanity to these otherwise dehumanized victims. But we want to understand, is there any data that actually like supports that actually happens? So one of the questions we asked was, do you believe that a fetus experiences pain during an abortion? And for both respondent groups, the imagery group and the non-imagery group, the most common answer was that they thought a fetus would experience pain during an abortion. But for the non-victim imagery group, it was only 42% of people that agreed with that. That was the most common answer. The others were either said no or they were uncertain. However, when imagery was used, we saw that number of people who affirmed fetal pain, even when it wasn't the image of a fetus that could experience pain. We didn't provide any biological evidence or anything. It jumped over 56% of people affirm fetal pain. So 14% increase in the affirmation of that. And what's interesting is the majority of that 14% increase didn't come from people that were uncertain about the issue, about whether or not fetuses experience pain during an abortion procedure. It actually came from people switching their answer, more or less, from the no to the yes side. So the non-AVI group, non-AVP group, almost 35% of them said fetuses do not experience pain during abortion. that number dropped to 23%, a 12% drop in the AVI group, in the AVP group, just by showing the image of abortion, whereas the uncertain opinion changed by less than 3%. So like, we're not flipping people that are uncertain, which is kind of surprising, but it's even, it's almost like they were uncertain, they're still uncertain, but people can immediately flip their mind on the issue by seeing the reality of what abortion is. So they, it's almost like they must have had a factual misunderstanding, I guess, of what abortion was, that the images can correct by bringing that humanity to the victim, I think.
Which shouldn't surprise, obviously it doesn't surprise either of us, but even many people who do any form of outreach, when they realize how many people are spouting the lie that they genuinely believe, that this is a clump of cells with no human attributes in any way, I think that this demonstrates very clearly how humanizing the images are and how they capture an identity that we can relate to, that now they're relatable, right? Like, not only is their presence established, but through establishing their presence, you foster a relationship with that child and you immediately put yourself in their shoes of like, I can see arms and legs and fingers and toes, therefore they must experience pain, because I have fingers and toes and arms and legs and I experience pain. And so I think that that captures in a really profound way the humanizing effect of these images in how they can even go beyond what the scientific data might show us on when pain capabilities are truly there, but rather capturing that human connection, human relationship, once you've established the presence of that child and humanized them.
Yeah, and I think like that's... It's really interesting to think about, because if we look even like in the past successes of different social reform movements, the predominant way they're able to switch people's mind on an issue like this or like other injustices of the past is by getting them to identify more directly with the victim of the injustice. And like if you think about Wilberforce and some of the images that he used, like the classic image of this African man in chains that says, "Am I not a man?" Basically appealing to, am I not like you? Am I not who you are? Can you imagine being me in these chains, being chains, being abused in this way? Appealing to that common humanity. You know, we even see it like, as I've been studying some of the success of the pro-choice movement and like the LGBTQ movement and things, and that's their primary method of persuasion is, I want to get someone to identify with the victim of their choosing, which is generally going to be a woman in crisis. And obviously we want to identify with that same woman in crisis as well. But, you know, to be frank, it's pretty easy to identify, to conceptualize a woman in a crisis. Because you can think about your sister, you can think about your mother, you can think about your wife, you can think about your daughter. And that is a very obtainable point of reference that they leverage very, very well. The pro-life movement has a very strong victim in the unborn child who's being violently killed, intentionally killed in the abortion procedure. However, we aren't as adept at presenting our victim and presenting in a way that allows people to see themselves in that victim. That's the remarkable thing about imagery, like you're saying, that it allows us to do that in the most real way that we possibly can, and actually lead with our victim, and not with just, you know, arguments or, statements, things like that.
Totally. In the training that I was doing with the students down in Florida, we talked a lot about capturing the who and the what. In that when the audience understands already both the who and the what, an image is not necessary. However, if ever they don't understand one of the two of them or neither of them, then an image absolutely is. And so when you hear about some random American who's been murdered, you know who's been murdered and you know what murder is, what has actually happened to them. Okay, you probably don't need an image for that. You look at something like the Holocaust where, okay, I know who Jewish people are, but I don't know what is happening to them. I need to capture the what through imagery for abortion, for slavery, for a number of other causes that you allude to and that you mentioned more in the study as well. Neither the who nor the what are understood. And you can bring that together in a profoundly compelling way with the abortion imagery. But what does that say about the people showing the imagery? Let's move into that third kind of category that you were evaluating. The impact that showing abortion victim imagery has on the perception of the person showing them, I guess.
Yeah. And I think, and this was probably the section of the survey that I was most excited to see some of the results about, because up until now, a lot of what we had been asking had been already, we were kind of reproducing, honestly, in some of the polling that you guys have done. So we're reproducing it, which is fine because we want to reproduce the results so that it adds further credibility to them. But I had not been aware yet of any questions that actually directly asked about the impact of people's potential negative view of pro-lifers using victim imagery on their opinions regarding abortion. So the argument basically that some pro-lifers might have is that, you know, I agree that victim imagery is good to use. However, it can be counteractive in a sense, because if we just use it too much or without consent or to the wrong people, it might have such a negative reaction in their mind or in their heart even towards pro-lifers that they shut off our actual argument that we might be making, and they become immediately oppositional to us and further entrenched potentially in their pro-choice position out of like defiance, defensiveness, or anger towards the pro-life community that is using what they might call potentially traumatizing or divisive images, right? So again, we want to be as effective as possible. So we wanted to understand whether or not that was the case. So after showing these images and going through some of these questions, we asked a question about what the respondents' view would be of pro-life people using those images as part of the pro-life movement. And what was interesting is most people did not have negative feelings towards pro-lifers using it. It was the plurality, like it was the if they were in the victim imagery group, the most common response was an increased negative view of pro-lifers, but it was only about 40%. So 6 out of 10 people are like, they like pro-life people doing that. They're probably very strong pro-life people, or they have no real opinion. They don't really care if we use it. But it is interesting that it was 40%, because the group that did not give victim imagery, and they're asked, what do you think about a pro-life person using these victim imagery images? Only about 30% of them had negative feelings towards pro-lifers. So that means that in my mind, a pro-life person saying anything pro-life is going to make about 30% of people upset, right? Which I guess is understandable. Like, I don't care what you say if you're a pro-choice person. I'm going to be upset that you say pro-choice stuff because I think it's wrong and it's immoral. Like, so we can kind of assume that 30% is the baseline, I guess. But the AVI group did have a 10% increase in negative feelings towards pro-lifers. So that could be significant for us to consider at least. So what we wanted to do then is compare those answers to what they said about abortion. Because to be completely frank, I don't really care if they like me or not. I don't do this to get like more friends. It would be a bad strategy. It would not be effective to get more friends by using a victim imagery, right? So what we want to do though is understand for people who did have increased negative feelings towards pro-life people for using these images, was that accompanied by an equal or greater level of increased negative feelings towards abortion itself? And that's where it got very interesting. So of the group that did not get images, like I said, about 30% of them had increased negative feelings towards pro-lifers. That's just the baseline. And about within like 1%, the same number of people had increased negative feelings towards abortion. So they you know, those groups are like, yeah, I don't like pro-life people doing this. I also kind of don't like abortion at about the same level, basically. What was interesting, though, with the imagery group, though, those who saw victim imagery, was that their increased negative feelings towards pro-lifers went up to about 40%, like we said earlier. But their increased negative feelings towards abortion went up to almost 50%, 49.5%. So for every 1% negative increase basically towards pro-life people, it was almost accompanied by a 2% increase in negative feelings towards abortion. So if we're willing to withstand a slight increase in people not liking us, we can almost like double our impact on their feelings towards abortion, which to me mean that I'm called to, make people feel less positively about abortion, not more positively about pro-life people, I think that is really important statistics for us to hold on to ultimately.
Absolutely. And like we've talked about already, the fact that, yeah, that 30% of people that are going to be pissed off regardless, to risk adding another 10% onto that for a 20% gain is absolutely worthwhile. And I would be very surprised if anybody didn't think that was worthwhile. If this was 0 to 10 and 0 to 20 kind of thing of like, either I can go with absolutely no pushback and have a 10% gain anyways, okay, I would still disagree, and I would hope that we would be able to challenge them towards risking that at it. But this isn't a matter of you're not going to endure anything. I know that while I was in university, we did something of a social experiment that was nowhere near as thorough as this, but we did the like pro-life presentation in a closed classroom, pro-life debate in a closed classroom, pro-life debate in the public setting, pro-life AVP in a public setting. And then we literally just gave out flowers with fetal facts on them. And we had fewer complaints about doing AVP style outreach than we did about the flowers with the fetal facts. And that there's a wide array of what influences people's opposition. And in some ways, it's a matter of effectiveness, right? In some ways, there's a greater hostility in opposition because there's a greater clarity that it will work, mm-hmm. right? That it's a matter of I like you less because I know that you're actually going to threaten my worldview and not the alternative. And so I'm sure that we can speculate a lot more, but I digress again. I'm just really excited about the outcomes here.
And I think that's a great observation because I think, you know, it also creates this, you know, I think it creates this level of cognitive dissonance in their mind when they, if I'm an avid supporter of abortion, who's never seen, for example, the reality of abortion, or maybe I have, and I see it for the first time on the street or in a presentation or whatever, and I see the violent destruction of a human being, I'm in disarray at that point because I support that thing vocally and publicly. I also support an idea, most likely, at least, that all humans should be treated without violence. And I'm seeing a human treated without violence that I support happening. And now I need to resolve that in some way. And a lot of people that we talk to around 30% of the time are going to resolve it by changing their opinion on abortion within that short period of time, just talking to them in a few minutes. Other people will react by, you know, lashing out and accusing us of lies or of hate or of whatever it is, because they need to resolve that dissonance by saying that we must be wrong or that must not be real or something is they're trying to grapple with truth that is conflicting in their mind, you know, and that's, I want to create that tension for as many people as possible, because if we can keep creating that tension, it's going to keep peeling people off and changing hearts and minds.
Absolutely. And I know this probably is a step outside of the purview of this study. And I hope that you'll excuse that. I think that one thing that people have in mind that they're erroneously likening to these kind of results are that, well, sure, if you're doing really effective work, but nobody's willing to come and volunteer with you or donate to you or get involved with your organization because they don't like the images, then what if you could mobilize the church? Ultimately, what if you could mobilize pro-lifers in a way that gets them out? And I'm sure that you probably don't have any statistical evidence on this, but would you, just from your own personal anecdotal experience, agree with the sentiment that there's more young people in particular that are streaming towards groups that are using abortion victim images, that regardless of whether the greater populace as a whole likes people who are using images, in some ways we're kind of asking the wrong question as well. Like, these results are really encouraging that we're not driving people away faster than we can get them to agree with our position. But also, if people are asking the sideways question of, but will your movement grow if you're using these images, that really that is a different question, because even though we're seeing a greater potentially hostility towards groups using abortion victim images, we're seeing radical growth and expansion with regards to membership, recruitment, donor increases. I know, again, that goes beyond the scope of the study, but just to build upon what you're finding, is that something that you would agree with, or do you think that that's something that might be way out of left field?
No, I absolutely agree. And honestly, like I was talking about before, we didn't always use victim imagery, and we were very nervous to start using it. And when we started using it, we're like, okay, let's keep this on the down low a little bit. Like, we're not going to lie or anything like that, but let's make sure we post a lot of non-imagery stuff that we do, and just like sneak stuff in all this here or there, whatever. And like, and you know, looking back on it, I still understand where we were coming from. I feel a little guilty about it. But at the same point, I'm like, you know, we still want to do the right thing, but we're worried about, yeah, we might lose volunteers. We might lose donors. We might lose public support. This organization might really suffer by doing what we think is right to do, or most effective to do, I guess. And the exact opposite has happened. When we started using this, I think we had 3 employees at Protect Life Michigan, and we've got almost 30 now. This summer, we're going to be over 50 employees full-time working at doing pro-life activism. We're doing an internship styled off after your guys' internship, where we actually had to shut down applications because we were getting too many people wanting to go, and too many high school and college kids wanting to go do victim imagery outreach that we couldn't actually really support it this year. Where we really came out in the past, you know, 12 to 24 months as using this as our primary source of persuasion, and produced a couple of videos to try to defend the use of victim imagery that Jonathan helped us craft and everything. And when we started publishing those out, we're like, okay, get ready for the donors' emails that they might have known yet that we did this. Get ready for them. We're going to get backlash. And we've gotten 0 negative responses from our donors. We've gotten some from outside of the organization, which was to be expected. But our actual supporters are more excited now about what we're doing than they were before, because people are hungry, for lack of a better word, I guess, hungry for something that will turn the tide. We feel like we're losing. And in reality, we are losing in a lot of ways, not everywhere, but in a lot of ways we are right now. And we have an opportunity. We have the data now that supports it, the survey. We have the data that CCBR has provided, you know, your actual like conversation data and your survey data that you've done. We've got Create Equal providing the same thing. We've got history that points to the use of imagery from Wilberforce to Lewis Hine to the Civil Rights Movement. We have all this evidence saying, hey, if you want to turn the tide, here it is. And when you present that to people, they're excited because they're like, finally, here's a solution. And it's not like the entirety of the pro-life movement should be doing this all in one thing or anything, but like, this is a dominant strategy that has been proven to change hearts. And we have a path to scale it if we can get more and more people to do it. And if we can scale it, we can actually defeat abortion.
Yeah. And maybe let's talk in that last area where, I mean, culturally, you guys in America are probably a decade, if not multiple decades, ahead of where we are culturally. And so, like, we're really not evaluating the question of legislation and the impact that AVP and victim imagery has on legislation whatsoever. But like, you guys are in the throes of things, and I know that there has been a vibrant debate of like, okay, abortion victim imagery works for educational purposes, but is it a hindrance for legislative purposes? And because you guys are kind of in that estuary of dealing with both, you need the education, but you also have opportunities legislatively. Is this a matter of, okay, we're gonna have to put all of our images away during election season or during policy votes and whatnot? Tell a little bit about and how relevant it is for you guys, the results that you guys saw with regards to the impact that imagery has on people's willingness to support or reject legislation.
Yeah, and it was actually really interesting. And I think that these specific questions you're bringing up now need a lot more investigation, because it was very clear and statistically significant. All the other questions that AVI had a profound impact on people's opinion on abortion. Where it became more murky was when we asked questions about, would you support a total ban on abortion? Would you support a heartbeat ban? And would you support a fetal pain ban, which we said would be around a 15-week ban? And when that happened, we found that it had mixed results or little impact on their support for legislation. And I think that there might be a couple reasons for some of that. So one, it did seem to impact and it was statistically significant that it had an impact on their support for a total ban on abortion, with the exception for life of the mother as a clause in the proposal. And so like the non-AVI group, about 27.8% of people said they would support that. with the group that saw victim imagery, that went up to almost 34%, a little over 6% increase. Not as significant as we were expecting, and but still, you know, does it hinder that effort? No, I think the evidence is clear that it doesn't hinder that effort. It instead, what it seems like it does is it doesn't impact directly their political decision making yet, and I think we can speculate potentially on why. I think part of it is probably political identities are different questions than views on particular like moral questions, I guess. So if I run into this as a firm Joe Biden supporter, progressive Democrat, or a self-identified liberal person versus a conservative, a Trump supporter, a pro-life person, whatever it might be, I think especially, you know, I can only speak to American politics, that political identity is going to shift the way that you perceive and make decisions about legislation, even when it might conflict with some underlying morality that you might have. I think that, like, that's why even, like, you know, religious, evangelical or Catholic people sometimes will go against their own teachings of the faith on political matters, in particular on abortion, fairly often, because political identity can be a driving force above religious affiliation or moral inclination or things like that. So I think we still have a big challenge in the pro-life movement to figure out how we can rip apart political identity and abortion beliefs a little bit more so that we open room for someone who you know, wants to see climate change legislation and union work and stuff like that enacted. So they generally align on the left, political left, but can still feel confident to hold pro-life views. And I think it's a big ask to have someone do that, honestly, because they become a political homeless person, more or less, because they're rejected by the right for everything else they believe, and they're rejected by the left because the left has so firmly attached itself to abortion rights ever since 2008, in the United States at least, that they've eliminated the opportunity to be a genuine pro-life electable Democrat, for example.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And even how, I think this again stems back to the value of the images and how we prioritize the abortion issue as well. I'd be very fascinated with further studies and further investment into anchoring their considerations with the humans impacted by abortion. That, yeah. I feel like for so many people that I talk to for election, it comes down to a very, I feel like selfish might be a little bit too strong, but I don't know how much too strong, in that, like, even between small C conservative candidates, Republican candidates, that kind of thing, people are often asking of like, what will this do to my bottom line? And at least in Canada, we're far more driven by fiscal kind of implications when it comes to, if I'm a business owner, I want somebody that's going to impact the business. If I'm low income and I need social programming or something like that, like, I'm driven by what will impact me, my family, and our bottom line. And for pro-lifers, we so often fall into the trap as well of the pro-life issue as an abstract issue that's rooted in theology and theoretical implications and not very real. And so I'd be very fascinated in building upon this to gauge, as pro-lifers in particular have a firmer and firmer grasp of abortion, how much more likely are they to prioritize abortion as their ballot item, as it were, over maybe finances, politics, other economic factors. But
that's a big challenge. Yeah, how do you open room for left-leaning individuals to support pro-life legislation, but yeah, and then how do you also prioritize abortion as a priority for our base or the institutions of power that we do have, Christians and the Republican Party, for example. Because it's not part of this study, but there's a lot of polls that ask, like, rank these issues based on importance. And for a Democrat that's pro-choice, abortion is going to be near the top. It's also not the number one thing, but it's going to be in the top two or three typically for a lot of, especially after Roe fell. For a Republican voter, it might not crack the top 10. It's, even though they might be pro-life in the sense that they'll support passively, at the very least, pro-life legislation, it's not going to rank as a deciding factor in how they vote in general. And we need to elevate that. And then also figure out how we can kind of rip apart that political identity that's so wrapped up on the and with the abortion industry on the left.
Absolutely. Okay. And so we've talked a lot about the details of the study. I'm glad that we've been able to dive in. I hope that at some point we can talk more about the data, and that as we build more and more data and more polling to continue the conversation. Is this public yet? And if so, if not, what are the responses or what are you anticipating and hoping that the responses will be from such a thorough and comprehensive kind of study?
Yeah, it is public. We're sharing it. And we're also going to be posting it on our website. We have a strategy page that kind of details out our larger strategy, and this as this one of the central focal points being the use of imagery. Yeah. And they can go to protectlifemi.org, and then if you can post it on your podcast and things like that as well. And then we're hoping, like, ultimately our goal is to we think that at this point there's been a few kind of big, at least this is my very rudimentary historical analysis of the pro-life movement. There's been a few kind of big moments in pro-life history as an entire movement. One was obviously 1973, and this is obviously just speaking to the states, but 1973, when Roe was decided, legalized abortion across the entire country through all 9 months, you know, very radical. And that obviously was significant, but it was also the launching point of what became the pro-life movement. So we actually formed this movement in the year or so leading up to that and the years after that, that was able to preserve the debate about abortion when a lot of other countries were not able to preserve the debate. The movement was extremely successful over the first several decades of keeping the abortion issue kind of undecided in the population, in a sense. I think the early 90s with the rise and then of like Operation Rescue and this movement that really was able to shut down abortion clinics and like mobilize hundreds of thousands of activists to do radical things for unborn children. And then the passage of the FACE Act that ultimately came because of that, that basically shut down the rescue movement, was another big moment in pro-life history, because it forced us to kind of reevaluate what was activism in the pro-life movement going to look like. And it led to like this CBR and Stephanie going to and getting CCBR and Create Equal and all these other groups that kind of like came from that time period. And then I think now we're in like that third really big moment in pro-life history because Roe was overturned. And the question of abortions returned to people to decide for the first time since the early 70s. And I think that what we want to help at Protect Life Michigan, what I want to do individually as much as possible, is help the pro-life movement figure out how we can navigate this new reality of the movement, and figure out what have we done well and where are we currently failing, and move quickly to pivot so that we don't lose more lives or potentially get in a position where it's going to be more difficult for us to win back the wins that we've had over the past couple of decades with all these ballot initiatives and things like that. They're setting up new challenges for us. So this study is just one piece of that where we can say, all right, here's a tactic that we can show is easy to implement, is scalable to society, and is remarkably effective at quickly changing minds on the issue.
Yeah, and I think that capitalizing on the momentum and doing this in an effective and timely manner is so valuable, especially because of, like you said, how much has changed in the last couple of years here, and to be able to capitalize on that and say, we are at a crossroads and we have an opportunity to not only push back and maybe a few of these states that are going to come up for these constitutional reforms and whatever this year, but also start pushing back that this isn't a matter of the sleeping giant has been awakened and he just needs to slap the snooze button and go back to sleep, but rather like this alarm is going to keep going and building and building and building. Yes. And we are no longer going to be ignored. And we are actually going to be able to triumph if we dedicate ourselves towards these kind of strategies that allow us not to punch above our weight, but to like massively hit gains in our weight loading, as it were. in a way that is going to say, you know, we worked so tirelessly building this strong foundation for decades and decades, and now is the time over the next decade to capitalize on that. And if we can make some major breakthroughs over the next 5, 6, 7 years leading up to 2030, I really think that we could be achieving something pretty amazing in America, which would serve as something of a blueprint, not only for us here in Canada, but around the world ultimately.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely the goal. We, you know, we have to be very careful not to fall into complacency or despair. Complacency being that, you know, we did our big thing, we got Roe overturned, and now let's you know, ride it out or whatever. Or despair because we've lost a lot since then. And I know it's been really difficult in Michigan for like me personally. It was very difficult to get past the Proposal 3 loss we had. Ohio was also similar. So we need to make sure that we're like, okay, whether or not we won or lost these battles, or will win or lose these battles, win or lose these battles this year, there are still hundreds of thousands of lives that are counting on us to do something. And there are still pro-life people that were radically committed to fighting against abortion that we need to keep engaged and figure out how to activate maybe for the first time sometimes. And if we do that, with effectiveness, not only will we be more effective at actually like changing hearts and minds and saving lives, but to your questions earlier about like, did we grow? Basically, the more effective, I firmly believe the more effective you are, the more people are going to flock to you to get involved. People are desperate for success as a movement. And if you can genuinely be successful, not fluffy successful or putting out a show or whatever, but if you're willing to grind day in and day out and go out and do the hard things that work well, people are going to flock to you. And we're seeing it. I know CCBR has seen it over the past 10 plus years. PLM has seen it. Create Equals, like we're seeing it over and over again. And I just want more and more people to have that opportunity to share in that success.
Absolutely. And so hopefully a whole bunch of people listen to this episode and their worlds are rocked and they say, you know what, like now is the time. Like now is the time to talk to our board of directors. Now is our time to talk to the other staff. Now is our time to really evaluate what we're doing. I don't know how many events and opportunities you would have off the top of your head, but as well, I hope that we're taking these principles and not necessarily jumping to the conclusion. It's been funny. I've worked with a few people here in Calgary. My colleague Quan has worked with a few people as well. I mean, even greater capacity of people who will take this kind of data and be like, okay, well, where do I order my sign? Where do I order a billion of these images and just like start delivering them? And often we make the analogy of these are power tools that if you know what you're doing and you use them effectively, they allow you to work incredibly efficiently. If you don't know what you're doing, if you don't know how to use these appropriately, you can cause a lot of damage to yourself, to others. And there are definitely ways that we could spike that 10% growth of people and their opposition to people using abortion victim images. That could get a lot higher if we're not careful. And we could create a world in which there is a greater hostility cultivated because of our conduct, our mannerisms, our methods and whatnot. And so bearing that in mind, we've talked a little bit about the internship already. How do people get plugged in and what kind of support guidance might they be able to find from a group like Protect Life Michigan?
Yeah. And I think you hit the nail on the head is there's, especially when we're talking about using victim imagery, there is a right way and there is a wrong way to use victim imagery. The use of imagery should be to bring humanity to the unborn, not to exploit their memory, for example, or to use them in inhumane ways or anything like that. Because ultimately they were this victim that deserves respect and honor, and they were denied that in their death. And we want to give them that in their memory. So if people want to get involved, like, you know, I think there's, you know, speaking to this kind of wing of the pro-life movement in particular that does this type of work, like CCBR and PLM and Create Equal, we want to see this evangelized out. So we're willing to help people get the resources and the training that they need to do so. If they're in Michigan, we've got young professional groups for people that are out of college. We've got 20 college groups for people that are in college and at high schools as well that we're able to partner with. So if you're in that under 40 range, you can get plugged in right with us. If you're not part of those networks, or you want to start your own thing, or you're like, well, I'm just in this little tiny town, I want to just change my neighborhood's opinions on this issue. We can give you the resources, you know, the power tools, basically, that you're saying that you need. And we're willing to help share the training and have you shadow and have you take part in our outreaches. This summer, we're going to be doing outreaches in Metro Detroit, full time, or our internship, just like the Canadian ones, bringing in high school and college kids and spending every week, almost every day out doing activism, engaging our community. And we'd love to have people that are interested get plugged in and figure out how they can help supplement that or take part in that or even shadow some of that. We want to see more and more people, for lack of a better word, like radicalized to do hard things. and we're willing to help invest in that because we've been the beneficiary of that. We wouldn't be here without groups like yours and Mark and Seth down in Ohio that were willing to do that for us. So we're willing to do the same thing for others as well.
Absolutely. I'm going to drop a bunch of those links in the show notes below for getting involved. Absolutely. They need supporters as well, financial partners, all that kind of thing. And so donate as well. Couldn't recommend that higher. Anything that I missed, anything that we should be chatting about that we haven't talked about yet from the study and outcomes that you saw?
No, I don't think so. I think that ultimately I just want to encourage people to consider the anecdotal evidence that we have. If you follow us on social media, we're sharing all the time stories of people whose mind have been changed just by seeing the image. Women whose children are alive today because they saw an image of abortion. People who are on staff with us now who were passive pro-life people and their life was rocked when they saw the reality of abortion for the first time, even though they were in church and talking about this issue before. So we have this anecdotal evidence. We have the historical case for the use of victim imagery in general, from Wilberforce to Hine to civil rights to to animal rights, to all these examples of how images like this can stir and change the population. And then we have the data as well. So, it's my humble opinion that until someone can kind of disprove that historical evidence, that data evidence, and that anecdotal evidence, we not only should consider using abortion victim imagery, I think we honestly have an obligation to use abortion victim imagery as a significant part of the pro-life movement strategy, and not just the pro-life movement in general, but you as a listener's strategy for how you want to get involved in the pro-life movement. We don't want to generalize our responsibility. If this is the tactic that works, there's nothing that stops you and a few of your friends from doing a tactic that works. You don't need to be on staff at CCBR or PLM. You can get everything you need from us and we'll partner with you and you can go out and you can do it. And even if you feel nervous or mess up or say something that's not the best way to say something, I promise that 99 times out of 100, it's going to be better than the alternative, which is you not being there, you not saying something. And someone will always be just as pro-choice as they were before if no one talks to them or no one does anything. But more often than not, if we're able to actually talk to somebody and engage on this issue, they will change their mind. It's just possible. And if we can scale it, we'll win. So,
absolutely. Absolutely. The last little nugget I'll say, all of this is done without any kind of apologetic behind the images. The polling that you guys showcased, this isn't even done with any kind of a defense of the pro-life worldview. Just imagine what these results will look like once there's a kind, compassionate person holding one of these signs, able to have an effective conversation. God is good, and the winds of change are coming, to use whatever metaphor we want to use. Trevor, thank you so much for giving me over an hour of your time, and for all the work that you and the team at Protect Life Michigan have done in not only implementing effective strategies, but demonstrating the outcomes and the evidence behind it. Thanks a ton.
Yeah, thanks, Cam. Appreciate it.
All right, folks, thank you for hanging in there all the way through that long episode. I'm sure many of you are not listening to this still on Tuesday, whether it's Wednesday or Thursday or Friday or sometime long in the future from time of recording. I really appreciate you tuning in, and I would welcome any questions, any feedback, any comments or concerns that you might have about this episode or ultimately any other episode. If you have suggestions for what we should cover on the show, I would absolutely love to hear your ideas and try my best to integrate them. And so big shout out to Protect Life Michigan and to Trevor and the entire team down there. They are absolute gems. And if you're anywhere near the Michigan area, or if you want to learn how you can catalyze your initiative wherever you're at, whether it's in Canada, in America, or around the world, learn from them. We're always happy to help here at the Canadian Center for Bioethical Reform as well. We're working with groups in New Zealand and Europe and all over the place. And so hit us up and let us know if you have any questions or thoughts or feedback. And may God bless you abundantly wherever you're at, however many hours are left in your day.